It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. This morning, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi officially called for the Judiciary Committee to draft articles of impeachment. Here is her full five-minute statement.
Let us begin where our founders began in 1776, when in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bonds which have connected them with another. With those words, our founders courageously began our Declaration of Independence from an oppressive monarch, for among other grievances, the king's refusal to follow rightfully passed laws. In the course of today's events, it becomes necessary for us to address, among other grievances, the president's failure to faithfully execute the law. When crafting the Constitution, the founders feared the return of a monarchy in America. And having just fought a war of independence, they specifically feared the prospect of a king president corrupted by foreign influence. During the Constitutional Convention, James Madison, the architect of the Constitution, warned that a president might betray his trust to foreign powers, which might prove fatal to the Republic. Another founder, Governor Morris, feared that a president may be bribed by a greater interest to betray his trust. He emphasized that this magistrate is not the king. The people are the king. They therefore created a constitutional remedy to protect against a dangerous or corrupt leader, impeachment. Unless the Constitution contained an impeachment provision, one founder warned, a president might, quote, spare no effort or means whatsoever to get himself reelected. Similarly, George Mason insisted that a president who procured his appointment in his first instance through improper and corrupt acts might repeat his guilt and return to power. During the debate over impeachment at the Constitutional Convention, George Mason also asked, shall any man be above justice? Shall that man be above it who can commit the most extensive injustice? In his great wisdom, he knew that injustice committed by the president erodes the rule of law, the very idea that of fair justice, which is the bedrock of our democracy. And if we allow a president to be above the law, we do so surely at the peril of our republic. In America, no one is above the law. Over the past few weeks, through the Intelligence Committee working with the Foreign Affairs and Oversight Committees, the American people have heard the testimony of truly patriotic career public servants, distinguished diplomats, and decorated war heroes, some of the president's own appointees. The facts are uncontested. The president abused his power for his own personal political benefit at the expense of our national security by withholding military aid and crucial Oval Office meeting in exchange for an announcement of an investigation into his political rival. Yesterday, the Judiciary Committee, at the Judiciary Committee, the American people heard testimony from leading American constitutional scholars who illuminated without a doubt that the president's actions are a profound violation of the public trust. The president's actions have seriously violated the Constitution, especially when he says and acts upon the belief, Article 2 says I can do whatever I want. No, his wrongdoing strikes at the very heart of our Constitution, a separation of powers, three co-equal branches, each a check and balance on the other. A republic, if we can keep it, said Benjamin Franklin. Our democracy is what is at stake. The president leaves us no choice but to act because he is trying to corrupt once again the election for his own benefit. The president has engaged in abuse of power undermining our national security and jeopardizing the integrity of our elections. His actions are in defiance of the vision of our founders and the oath of office that he takes to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Sadly, but with confidence and humility, with allegiance to our founders and a heart full of love for America, today I am asking our chairman to proceed with articles of impeachment. I commend our committee chairs and our members for their somber approach to actions which I wish the president had not made necessary. In signing the Declaration of Independence, our founders invoked a firm reliance on divine providence. Democrats, too, are prayerful, and we will proceed in a manner worthy of our oath of office to support and defend the Constitution of the United States from all enemies, foreign and domestic. So help us God. Thank you.
So help us God. Nancy Pelosi. At just after 9 o'clock Eastern Time this morning, it is obviously a historic moment. And with me now, Princeton historian Julian Zelizer, who is also a CNN contributor and author of books including Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974, which came out this year and forthcoming next year, Burning Down the House, Newt Gingrich, The Fall of a Speaker, and the Rise of the New Republican Party. Professor Zelizer, whether people are for it or against it, you're here at a grave moment. How did Nancy Pelosi, who resisted impeachment for so long during and even after the Mueller investigation, get to this point?
I think the president forced her hand. It was very clear after the Mueller report she did not want to do this. She believes it is and has been consistent, politically risky for the Democrats. But I think she reached a point where she felt, as the leader of the House, that the Democrats, with the Republicans, as much as they could get their support, needed to move forward with this Ukraine investigation. And so I think it's about what the president did rather than about her having some turning point moment.
Speaker Pelosi had a lot of history in there. Started with the Declaration of Independence, or a quote from it. You're a historian. Can you put some of that in context for us?
Sure. It was a three-part speech. The first part of the speech is about the founders and what they feared and why they feared a monarchy, why they feared a leader who would be unaccountable, and repeated some of what we heard in the hearings yesterday. The second part was about what the Intelligence Committee found with arguments that the president did exactly what the founders feared. And finally, a conclusion that this fits the bill of where this all started and exactly what impeachment is about.
You mentioned the hearings yesterday, and the speaker's declaration comes on the morning after 8.5 hours of testimony by four law professors, three for impeachment and one against. Here is my 44-second tiny desk version.
The abuse of office occurs when the president uses a feature of his power, the awesome power of his office, not to serve the interests of the American public, but to serve his personal, individual, partisan, electoral interests. That is what the evidence before the House indicates.
Bribery occurred when an official solicited, received, or offered a personal favor or benefit to influence official action, risking that he would put his private welfare above the national interest.
You need to stick the landing on the quid pro quo. You need to get the evidence to support it. It might be out there, I don't know, but it's not in this record.
Law professors Noah Feldman of Harvard first, Pam Carlin of Stanford second, and the skeptic at the end there, Jonathan Turley of George Washington University. Professor Zelizer, how much did that incredibly reductive montage represent the day?
I think you captured it. I think you had two of the three law professors who basically said, this is exactly what we mean when we mean an impeachable offense, and argued that there's more than enough justification for the House to move forward. And Turley was interesting in that he didn't actually defend the president, nor did he deny what the president had done, as many Republicans have said. But he argued there needed to be more evidence. He argued that there needed to be more testimony. And many people are critical of what he said. But that was the basis of the defense. Not what the president did was okay. way, but there's not enough to impeach.
Well, there was a huge paradox in that. Maybe this is the criticism of him that you're referring to, but here is the White House blocking testimony by so many people who have direct evidence, and yet he says you can't impeach because you don't have enough direct evidence.
Well, it's funny. I was looking back at 1974, and one of the big issues Democrats talked about in the final months was obstruction. And they really made clear that the White House wasn't allowing this investigation to happen, and they were doing everything possible to tie up Congress. I don't think that's been as clear right now. And so what Turley is calling for is literally impossible because the president is flexing his muscle to stop people from testifying and to stop evidence from being shared. So it's an imagined process that Turley was talking about. And in itself, it gets to another part of the impeachment.
And I don't even know if he's right about sticking the landing, not sticking the landing. And for people who don't watch Olympics gymnastics, sticking the landing means to complete the move and land straight up on your feet. Here's a stick the landing debate moment from yesterday. This is longer than the entire montage. It's Republican Matt Gaetz, then Democrat David Cicilline rebutting him with law professor Noah Feldman. This is the Republicans' oft-repeated argument that almost none of the witnesses from the last round of hearings, Colonel Vindman, Ambassador Taylor, Fiona Hill, etc., actually spoke to the president directly.
The only direct evidence came from Gordon Sondland, who spoke to the president of the United States, and the president said, "I want nothing. No quid pro quo." And you know what? If wiretapping a political opponent's an impeachable offense, I look forward to reading that Inspector General's report, because maybe it's a different president we should be impeaching.
The gentleman's time has expired, Mr. Cicilline.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Professor Feldman, let me begin by stating the obvious. It is not hearsay when the president tells the president of Ukraine to investigate his political adversary, is it?
It is not.
It is not hearsay when the president then confesses on national television to doing that, is it?
It is not.
It is not hearsay when administration officials testify that they hear the president say he only cares about the investigations of his political opponent, is it?
No, that is not hearsay.
And there's lots of other direct evidence in this 300-page report from the Intelligence Committee. So let's dispense with that claim by my Republican colleagues.
Congressman David Cicilline, Democrat of Rhode Island there with Harvard Law professor Noah Feldman. Professor Zelizer, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's hard to look back at the Intelligence Committee hearings and say that they didn't offer a huge amount of proof of what the president was doing, what he wanted, and that he was at the center with his inner advisors of this operation. I don't think many people outside Republican circles disagree. There might be some people who say impeachment is just a bad thing and we shouldn't use it. And this isn't extreme enough. But to argue that the committee didn't prove its point and stick its landing really just seems to ignore the facts that were in front of us.
And here is one example of what Congressman Cicilline was referring to there. Remember when the scandal first broke in September, President Trump basically said, "Yeah, I asked Ukraine to investigate the Bidens." And
by the way, likewise, China should start an investigation into the Bidens. Because what happened in China is just about as bad as what happened with Ukraine.
It's largely in plain sight, and Democrats tear their hair out over this and the fact that that in and of itself isn't seen as broadly impeachable because he is soliciting interference in our election campaign from foreign powers.
Yeah, I think Congress has had trouble with what the president does right in front of our eyes. A lot of this isn't about some secret smoking gun tape or recording, whether it was obstruction with the Mueller report or even with Ukraine, whether it's soliciting foreign interference. He does it right in front of the cameras or on his Twitter feed. And so I think there are mountains of evidence about what he did. And Democrats keep saying this, Republicans keep denying it, and that's the quandary about how to deal with this moment.
Did you, as a historian and/or political analyst, see the point of yesterday and what, if anything, it all meant? 8.5 hours of four law professors?
Sure. I mean, it wasn't the most scintillating moment in the hearings, but I think that Speaker Pelosi wants to bring weight to what they're doing. She does understand the enormity of voting to impeach the president of the United States, and she wanted to show there are very respected scholars who think this is more than legitimate, and this is exactly the kind of moment that the founders had in mind. So I think it's just part of a bigger package that she's putting forward.
My guest is Princeton historian Julian Zelizer, who is also a CNN contributor and author of books including Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974, which came out this year. We can take some phone calls for Professor Zelizer. Any questions you have, any reactions to hearing Speaker Pelosi's announcement this morning, any reactions to anything from those 8.5 hours that you either binged on or happened to bump into for a few minutes yesterday, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. In historical context, your book, published this year, is Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974. That was the year of the Nixon resignation. So where does today fit in, or what's the big sweep of the last 45 years since 1974 that brings us to today?
Well, it's a issue that starts in 74 with the corruption of presidential power and a question that was put at the forefront of public debate. And that culminated with the president finally stepping down and losing Republican support. And it's the same issue that we're dealing with many decades later. But in that time, a lot of the politics has changed. The Republicans have become much more firmly polarized and united as a group, so they're less willing to bend. The conservative media has become much more sophisticated and offered a counter platform. And so you have a very similar issue. Some would say Trump's situation is worse, but it's not clear there is a political mechanism for holding a president accountable when the polarization is in the state that it is.
You say the Republican side has hardened. Here's a fault line from 1998, the Clinton impeachment, and this is Gerald Nadler, who's going to manage those new impeachment articles, sounding a different tune back then.
It is, in fact, a peaceful procedure for protecting the nation from despots by providing a constitutional means for removing a president who would misuse his presidential power to make himself a tyrant or otherwise to undermine our constitutional form of government. To impeach a president, it must be that serious.
Nadler seemed much more worried about the fault lines of one-party impeachment then than he does now. Did something objective change, would you say, as a historian, or is he just now a lawyer for the prosecution instead of the defense?
What changed is the substance of what they're looking at. I understand partisanship matters for Democrats, too, but I think just taking that statement, I don't think Congressman Nadler thought that the House was looking at a president committing truly impeachable offenses in 1998.
But at least in that statement, taken out of context, he's arguing a narrow point, which is that a partisan impeachment, that is, with the support of only one party, eventually the Nixon resignation, which was moving toward impeachment, had the support of plenty of both parties. Mm-hmm. The Clinton one never did, and he called it illegitimate at that point just on that basis.
Yeah, no, he will have to reckon with his own words. I don't think he totally foresaw how things would unfold. I don't think he imagined where the Republican Party would go, that you'd have many Republicans contradicting their own national security ideas right now, contradicting their own ideas about law and order and standing by the president. So it creates a problem for that perspective, that you need bipartisan support to move forward. In an era, you're not going to get it. So then what do you do if the president abuses power? Do you say we just don't deal with it until the election, or do you actually move forward? And I think he is now in that camp.
As a historian of polarization, have you given any thought to the different alternative outcomes here? That, let's say the Democrats were to do some version of censure and move on. That doesn't seem likely, but some version of getting a lot of people on board, maybe they'd get Republicans on board for that, to say what the president did was bad, like Professor Turley, the Republicans' witness yesterday, said, very objectionable, and yet impeachment is an excessive remedy, and then move on, versus if this impeachment takes place and he's not removed by the Senate.
I think it's a good point and it's a good question. I'm not sure Republicans would support censure either. I think that's the misconception always that, well, this they would support. I think they are going to oppose any kind of reprimand against the president. So the speaker's idea is if you're going to do this, do it Right. And show the perspective of the Democrats that this was fundamentally wrong and live with a president who has to run as an impeached president.
You're probably right. That was another of my takeaways from yesterday that we talked about a lot on our evening special last night after all the hearings, that the Republicans were not conceding what appear to be the facts. They were using every little, you know, mechanism to say, well, this wasn't exactly this or that wasn't exactly that, obscuring what appears to be the big picture about the president's actions and not conceding the facts, not going to wrong but not impeachable. The president doesn't want them to go there. He keeps insisting that the phone call was perfect, and he keeps bristling when any Republican goes too bad but not impeachable.
That's the dynamic that has defined this whole process, and it won't matter what the exact punishment is, whether it's censure or impeachment, nor will the president ever respond differently. And so then the logic is use the constitutional powers afforded to the House and have this vote and put it on the historical record. And the president has to live with that.
We played the Nadler clip from 1998. To be fair, here is Lindsey Graham in 1998. We played this clip the other day, but I think it's worth repeating in this context. Also on the flip side of where he is today.
So the point I'm trying to make is you don't even have to be convicted of a crime to lose your job in this constitutional republic. If this body determines that your conduct as a public official is clearly out of bounds in your role, thank God you did that. Because impeachment is not about punishment. Impeachment is about cleansing the office. Impeachment is about restoring honor and integrity to the office.
More fault lines. Is any shared truth possible, if not shared perception?
I'm not sure anymore, and it's hard not to be cynical that those fault lines are not totally in place, strong and impermeable, given what we are seeing. There, Lindsey Graham is arguing the exact reverse, meaning with Nadler, the question is, has politics changed so much he couldn't even imagine where this would all go? Graham is just flipping around in terms of presidential behavior, and he's done this consistently.
Pete, Sussex County, New Jersey, you're on with Princeton historian Julian Zelizer. Hi, Pete.
Hi, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to ask if there might have been a better time to bring up the whole impeachment thing, you know, perhaps during, you know, whether we talk about, you know, emoluments with Saudi Arabia or just any of Trump's business ventures and stuff, or even, you know, when we had like the border issue, you know, 2 years ago or whatever, and just maybe get the opinion there of whether the Democrats should have done something then as opposed to now.
Yeah, timing's an imperfect art in politics, and it's always hard to know when to make big moves, certainly on something like impeachment. There are people who thought after the Mueller report that was the moment. It would be further away from the election and the primary season, and there was a certain amount of momentum. That said, you know, the speaker can't always pick when she does it. What she was looking for was something with great clarity that she could explain to the public. And when the whistleblower provided that great clarity, she decided to move. So she would probably argue it wasn't about the timing. It was about the substance that would be, you know, the best substance for making this case.
Mayat, you're on with Julian Zelizer. Hello, Mayat.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have 2 points. First of all, I heard a clip of Jonathan R. Turley in 1998, and what he had to say is very brief, but he said, if you decide, he was talking before the hearing regarding the Clinton impeachment, he said, if you decide that certain acts do not rise to impeachment, you will expand the space for executive conduct, and we will have to live with that expansion. Now, it was less than 70 days. The Democrats are at 71 days. And so his argument was just the opposite. And it shows, I'd like the guests to comment on the supreme hypocrisy of the of such Republican-leaning people. And the last point I want to make, and I'd like his comment, is as a person of color, and I'm hearing this from my community, the black intelligentsia and people of color in general, we feel abandoned because we don't feel that there's any downside. Since the Republicans are going to ignore bribery, where is the downside to putting the whole panoply, according to Liz Holtzman, Nixon was going to be impeached on lying to the public. And as a person of color, throughout the land, there are laws against inciting violence, disturbing the peace, that's sometimes called inciting riot. And that's the issue of national and domestic security. So why the Democrats don't seem to be moving to put laying the whole thing out, including emoluments, which the one of the professors did bring up.
Gotcha. And what? Sorry, you want to finish that thought, Maya? You'll take your answer off the phone, off the air?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much. Professor Zelizer, there's a lot in there. There's one piece that I want to follow up. What are you thinking?
On the first part, yes, that's what we're talking about with Lindsey Graham for sure, that there's a lot of hypocrisy. People have talked about Turley's opinions in the Clinton impeachment being very different. So I don't know what to say other than yes. I think some people are not only hypocritical. They see each case differently, but there's certainly lots of hypocrisy going on. On the second case, it's a big issue. Do you just stick with this if you're Democrats, or do you go for the whole thing, the emoluments, the Mueller report?
And she brings up incitement of violence, which is something that I've mentioned before. When the president tweets that if he's impeached, there's going to be a new civil war, and puts civil war in caps, like the civil war, if he's not if he's not inciting violence, he's at least predicting it in a provocative way. And we know that there have been other instances where he tells people, if somebody's making trouble at one of my rallies, don't be too nice, I'll pay your lawyer bills. It's incitement to violence. I don't know why that isn't an article of impeachment.
No, and we don't actually know what the articles will be. There's been some hints they'll be broader than narrower in the final version. A writer, Mike Tomosky, wrote a piece, and he said, we don't remember everything that Nixon did. What you remember are a few key things, like trying to stop the investigation through the CIA, or trying to break into the Brookings Institution. You remember some key stories. And I think the speaker's idea is not dissimilar, that what she is focusing on is not the whole picture. The whole picture is clear. But this one story, which captures everything in a nutshell. She might be wrong. It might have been better to go broad and to paint a bigger picture of what this president has done, from the violence and try, potential to incite violence, to the emoluments and more. But she went narrow.
Let me play one more clip. Yesterday's hearing coincided, as you noted on your Twitter feed, with Trump getting mocked by other NATO leaders in Europe. Some of it behind his back, but caught on tape. And Joe Biden, the object of Trump's wished for investigation, made this campaign commercial.
World leaders caught on camera laughing about President Trump. Several world leaders mocking President Trump.
They're laughing at him.
My administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country. Didn't expect that reaction, but that's okay.
World leaders mocking and ridiculing him for being completely off balance.
Allies are deeply worried about him. They say he's becoming increasingly isolated. Something is very wrong.
The world sees Trump for what he is, insincere, ill-informed, corrupt, dangerously incompetent, and incapable, in my view, of world leadership. And if we give Donald Trump four more years, we'll have a great deal of difficulty if ever being able to recover America's standing in the world and our capacity to bring nations together.
So So again, that's a Joe Biden campaign commercial that just dropped last night. And obviously that's not to endorse in any way. That's just to show how this candidate is seizing the moment. Do you see Biden, take off your political historian hat and put on your political analyst hat. Do you see Biden as a political winner, political loser, or neither from all of this? Investigate the Bidens.
You know, I thought initially this would really hurt him. And I thought there's part of the Trump administration that was willing to go down impeachment just so they could get this story out as many times as possible at a national level and just smear his character. But so far, it seems that that's not happening. His support remains very solid. And it might be that this is what Biden needed to actually figure out how to deliver a message other than I'm most electable. This is a powerful ad. If you see it, it's even more powerful. And it's connected to the vote on impeachment. It's the basic question of 220. It's not about Medicare for all. It's not about other policies. It's can the nation withstand four more years of this? And he captured it in an ad.
And the NATO moment this week kind of intersects with the investigation moment. Trump was trying to say it intersected in that it was un-American, unpatriotic for Congress to hold an impeachment hearing at the same time that he's representing the United States overseas. But another way to look at it is we have simultaneously Trump being held to account for being corrupt, allegedly, in his foreign policy toward Europe. And over there, Trump looking incompetent and even maybe on the side of the Russians in American foreign policy toward Europe.
That's exactly right. You flip it around. This is why you have the impeachment investigations. You need a president who the country knows is accountable, who will be making decisions that don't go against the national interest for selfish reasons and for his own campaign. And this is part of why people are laughing at NATO, part of why people are moving away from him. Allies don't trust him, just like a lot of the public doesn't trust him. And so Democrats have to make that clear. But it looks nationally, that's where the polls are. That's what people see. Republicans don't see that, but it's not a great position for an incumbent to be.
It was very high school, that tape.
Yeah, no.
Those leaders talking behind his back. Oh, yeah, he had a 40-minute news conference first. Things like that. I wonder what they say behind Macron's back and behind Merkel's back.
Right.
Who knows? What happens next? Who actually writes articles of impeachment now that Pelosi this morning ordered them written? And who decides how broad or how narrow they will be?
Well, the real answer is she will write them and her staff will write them. Power is centralized right now in her office. She said the committees will write them, so Schiff and Nadler ultimately will be drafting it. But never forget that the speaker runs her caucus with a strong hand. And she will kind of dictate how narrow they will be. I do think, based on what we heard, they'll generally focus on Ukraine and the efforts to stop the investigation, and then she'll move it forward to a vote. She will not bring it to a vote until she is sure that she has enough votes. She never votes without 218. She says if you don't have 218 votes, you're just having a conversation. So she's going to make sure the language matches where all those swing district Democrats are willing to go.
Princeton historian Julian Zelizer, who is also a CNN contributor and author of books including Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974, which came out this year and forthcoming next year, Burning Down the House, Newt Gingrich, The Fall of a Speaker, and the Rise of the New Republican Party. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
We'll have more on impeachment coming up later in the show with Washington Post columnist Ruth Marcus. Coming up next, what happened to Kamala Harris?